This is Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. What's happening to immigrants seeking asylum or refuge in the U.S. has many thinking about another time, a time when another population was incarcerated in this country in the name of national security. The time was World War II, and the people were Japanese Americans. Many of them wouldn't speak openly about their incarceration. That means their children and grandchildren don't really know that much, but they've found artifacts that have survived the last 75 years, pieces tucked away in attics and closets and basements. That period of history is the subject of a podcast called Order 9066. It's from American Public Media and the Smithsonian Museum of American History. KALW will air stories from the podcast tonight, tomorrow, and Thursday at 6 p.m. And we're going to air a preview right now. It features Kate Ellis, the producer, museum specialist Noriko Sanafuji, and San Franciscan Norman Ishimoto.
Sanafuji often meets with people in their homes to see if they have photographs, documents, and other artifacts from the incarceration that offer clues to the larger history.
I like to do actually a physical visit if possible, because sometimes you never know to what they have in their garages or like studies, and because the individuals or the family might not think that's really important, historically powerful, but then there's like a hidden gem. Wow, this is really powerful.
For younger Japanese Americans especially, these objects have important stories to tell.
For the third generation, well, it's a discovery of their identity. I think it's like a self, it seems like a self-discovery. That's another part of their identity has been like hidden away, tucked away, because you never talked about it at a dinner conversation.
Norman Ishimoto comes from one of those families. He's a sansei, or third-generation Japanese-American.
One of the funny things was that as a child, I would hear my parents, when they would meet other nisei or isei, they would say, oh, well, what camp were you in? And they would say, oh, well, I was in blah, 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 and I had no idea, you know, Manzanar or Heart Mountain or, you know. And they would say, oh, so did you know the Sato family? Oh, yes, they were on the block next to us, or they were in our church. And I'm thinking, well, you know, I'm in Cub Scouts. It's not like the Cub Scout weekend camp. And so I'd ask my mother, you know, what is this camp you're talking about? And she would get really upset and say, don't ask that again. Okay, so I wouldn't ask again.
When he was older, Norm was able to get some information from his parents, Paul and May Ishimoto. But after they died, he learned even more. Norm and his siblings found some of his parents' belongings from the years they were incarcerated. These were things they'd never heard about or seen before. With Noriko Sanafuji's help, they donated them to the National Museum of American History.
So through the Ishimoto family's collection, there are a number of amazing artifacts. But the one stood out was this two Scottish Terrier pin that was made by Paul Ishimoto, Norm's father.
It's a sort of lapel pin with two Scottish terriers carved out of wood, dangling from strings attached to another piece of wood that has an engraving.
It's really cute. It's fairly small, but each dog is wearing a collar. And one says Paul, and the other one says May. And it's all handmade. And on the top, it says May. And the story is the two, May and Paul, meets in camp. They were in Jerome, Arkansas.
When Paul arrived at Jerome, he volunteered to work in the camp hospital.
Very fortuitously, the first time he reports to work, the person he's supposed to report to is my mother. And he sees her and thinks, oh, what beautiful eyes. And from that point, he's smitten.
Paul was really like love at first sight. He really wanted to date May. But I think May was not that interested in at first.
May was in her early 20s. Her mother had just died of stomach cancer. Her father was dying of the same thing. And now she was in charge of 8 siblings, the youngest just 3 years old.
So my mother, with all of this, could care less about anything, like a date, She kept telling him, well, I don't think it's possible. He would actually go across camp to attend the same church services that the family attended so he could suck up to his hopeful father-in-law.
Paul started carving pins for May, including the terrier pin, with her name emblazoned on each one.
So he was making all kinds of accessory to try to win her heart.
After a while, he even proposed, but May turned him down.
My mother says, don't bother me. I just can't get married. I got too much on my plate. And then she says, about 2 weeks later, she thinks, I'm done with him. Then she sees this figure in the twilight, in the distance. She didn't recognize him. Then she says, oh, it's him. He hadn't shaved. He had lost so much weight. He says, I can't eat. I can't sleep. I just have to marry you. And at this point, my mother says, you look so terrible. He can't last more than a couple of months. And then I'll be done with him.
The two get married in April of 1944 in Jerome. And they even actually get a permission to go buy a wedding suit. And we have a May's wedding suit in our collection as well.
Norm says they found around 10 pins that Paul crafted for May. Those pins tell one story of courtship in camp. Many other young people dated or got married while living behind barbed wire. Romance was one aspect of life that continued, even in camp. Noriko Sanofuji handpicked many of the objects in the Righting a Wrong exhibit as a way to get visitors engaged in the narratives of the incarceration. The pin Paul made is a perfect example.
I think it really connected with the visitors because it's a very pretty and cute pin. And then the two dogs on the pin. I thought it was an entry point for when the visitors come that, oh, this is something so precious, but I would like to learn more about the history behind it. So hopefully those entry points work.